Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. In 1936, John Steinbeck published a strange, cold, and unsettling novel about a strike in the California fruit orchards. The book, In Dubious Battle, doesn't hand you heroes to root for, and it offers very little comfort along the way. It watches its characters the way a scientist watches something under a microscope. But it's also the book that made Steinbeck's name as an authority on farm labor, set him on the road that would lead him to the Grapes of Wrath, and opened a window onto a chapter of our state's history that we're still living with today. To help make sense of it, I'm joined by Dr. John Dawson, a third-generation Californian raised in Santa Rosa, who fell for Steinbeck the way a lot of us did, in middle school classroom, and never quite let it go. He's a scholar of American naturalism, as much at home with Jack London and Frank Norris as with Steinbeck. And while he moved across the country to teach at the University of North Georgia, he spent his career writing about the California he left behind. Over the course of our conversation, we get into real Depression-era strikes that inspired the novel, the migrant camps and company stores of California agriculture, Steinbeck the reporter versus Steinbeck the novelist, his uneasy relationship with communism and ideology, and why a story rooted in 1933 still reads like this morning's newspaper. This was the first stop in our Steinbeck Labor series, so stick around to the end, and we conclude this conversation by looking forward to our next book of Mice and Men. Let's go meet Dr. John Dawson. Dr. Dawson, to start, I wanted you to just tell the story of how you came to Steinbeck and then what pulled you towards scholarship rather than just being a reader of his novels and short stories.
Great. My interest in Steinbeck really came about from growing up in California. I'm a third generation Californian. I was raised in Santa Rosa. I did my undergrad at UC Santa Cruz, go banana slugs, my master's degree at San Francisco State, and I lived in San Francisco for many years before moving to Georgia, where I've been for the last 20 years now. Like many Californians of my generation, I first encountered Steinbeck in middle school. We read Of Mice and Men when I was in seventh grade, read The Pearl in eighth grade, read East of Eden in high school, and I found myself drawn to Steinbeck's characters, his themes, his artistry, even at times in my life when I was not that interested in reading anything other really than Baseball Weekly and the sporting news and things like that. My interest in Steinbeck really took off in between my senior year of high school and my freshman year of college when I read The Grapes of Wrath for the first time. I was becoming very interested in radical politics at the time, very interested in labor history at the time, and those concerns dovetailed so perfectly into the novel that blew me away on every level. I encountered In Dubious Battle by accident. I was browsing at Green Apple Books in San Francisco, and I came across this lovely, it's a 1973 Bantam. Beautiful. Paperback edition. The pages are all falling out as I've poured through it so many times. I'm missing, I think, the last chapter in its entirety. Now, this is a book I've been interested in Steinbeck for quite some time at this point. I'd never even heard of. I didn't really know. I hadn't delved into the bios or anything like that or any of the secondary criticism. And then the switch from just becoming a general reader to becoming a scholar of Steinbeck really emerged when I was trying to think of a research project for my dissertation in grad school. I knew I was interested in working Jack London, who's my favorite author of all time. I knew that I was interested in working on Frank Norris and doing something, generally speaking, with American naturalism. And then I thought, man, there's a third writer that I'm, a really obvious choice that I'm missing out on. Who could that be? Who's that other writer associated with naturalism from California? Oh, okay, my other favorite writer. Yeah, and then that was the switch. And I still laugh at myself for moving across country to work on three writers from California, and often in relation to California history, no less. I have no foresight whatsoever, but it's always nice to have an excuse to come back to California for research purposes, if nothing else.
You're not the scholar furthest from California that we've talked to that studies Steinbeck. We had a German academic about Steinbeck, and I think that's about as far as you can get.
Oh, yeah.
So Steinbeck over the years has had a mixed reputation in the academy, beloved by readers, of course, yeah, but mixed in the academy. Some of his work is considered deficient in certain ways. There's different periods of his career that are valued more than others. Where do you land on his kind of critical reputation, and where do you think he currently sits within the academy?
I'll start my answer by saying that I have rarely encountered Steinbeck's work as a student in a college classroom. The only Steinbeck text that I read for a class was The Pastures of Heaven in a class on the American short story cycle, and since it's one of the big ones, it has to be in there. All of my other reading in Steinbeck really came on my own. And yeah, there is this tendency toward elitism, go figure, in college literature classrooms, and those writers who happen to attain any measure of commercial success are viewed as being deficient in some way. And again, as someone who focuses on London as well, who was the most popular and highest paid writer of his generation, like, he's never come up in any class of mine aside from a course on American realism and naturalism, where again he's one of the big ones and you can't ignore him.
Do you think that's coastal snobbery? Is that what's going on there? You teach on the East Coast, you're from California.
Everywhere. Okay, it's everywhere. And okay, in my own classes, I look for any excuse I can to fit Steinbeck in. And students always respond really well to him because he's such a gripping writer whose themes are still so relevant to many of my students' lived experiences. I mostly teach composition and sophomore surveys, so that limits what I can teach. I did squeeze in The Grapes of Wrath in an upper division class on American realism and naturalism. My students struggled with the reading load that I assigned. I couldn't spend a month on the book, so it's like, all right, let's read 75 pages a night. We'll get there. And they did not like that aspect of it.
I've got a few general questions about Steinbeck. Sure. How much do you think Steinbeck's writing would change if he was located somewhere else?
Oh, that's a very interesting question because, yeah, so much of his early work in particular is so closely associated with and rooted within a specific place, the California settings that he was familiar with. And even though he spent a large portion of his life outside of California, he kept going back to those settings in some way, shape, or form. So I imagine that he would be a dramatically different writer. I think he would still have a pretty similar set of shared thematic concerns just because of the time period in which he was writing so much of his best known work. You're not going to grow up during the Depression, or I should say, come as a writer during the Depression and remain untouched by that. But without literally being in California for so much of that period, I can't imagine what the fiction would look like.
Hmm. People often group In Dubious Battle with Of Mice and Men and then The Grapes of Wrath as kind of a quasi-labor trilogy.
Yeah.
Do you see them as a deliberate sequence, or do you see them as their own kind of separate units?
So they are definitely joined by setting theme and context that in many ways it's in dubious battle that sets Steinbeck on the path that would culminate in the Grapes of Wrath. After the publication of In Dubious Battle, he was viewed as this expert on farm labor and labor relations. This led George West to approach him to write a series of articles for the San Francisco News that would appear in October of 1936 about agricultural migrants in California.
I might as well ask this question because you're answering my next one. Is I was going to ask you about the kind of the relationship between reporter Steinbeck and novelist Steinbeck and how those kind of feed each other and work together.
Okay. Yeah. Steinbeck as a reporter, I'm mostly familiar with the Harp of Gypsies and some of the later work around that same time period, Dubious Battle in California, Starvation under the Orange Trees, things like that. And it looked to me at this time that the journalism was really a source of some of the raw materials that would go into the fiction, where he was seemingly testing out some of the ideas. And there's so many parallels you can draw between the articles in The Harp of Gypsies, aka Their Blood is Strong, and then ideas and plot points and episodes and scenes in The Grapes of Wrath. I think we can do the same with Dubious Battle in California and In Dubious Battle and The Grapes of Wrath.
So Steinbeck, seemingly to me as a reader, always resists sentimentality that comes with some depictions of suffering, and there's a lot of violence and death in this particular book that we'll talk about in a minute. What do you think that says about how Steinbeck views suffering in the context of these books?
I'm not entirely sure how to go about answering that. Again, I think that he is working within the broader trajectory of naturalist fiction. And then Emile Zola's initial kind of formulations of naturalism, you know, the writer is supposed to take an objective distance from their subject. If you, the episodes, characters, events, dispassionately as a scientist through his microscope, it's the text is a lab experiment, and the writer should not get too involved. Now, Zola never practiced what he preached in that regard, and I don't think that Steinbeck necessarily does either. I think A Dubious Battle is one of his more detached novels, much more so than, say, The Grapes of Wrath, something like that. But there definitely is more of a clinical air to
anthropological, sociological.
Yeah.
And in that sense, it begs the question about what's the importance of characterization if you're thinking in this kind of broad, almost world building that he's doing in this novel.
Yeah, and then just if you look at some of the specific characters too, so we have Doc Burton, who takes this same very clinical air toward the workers in Dubious Battle. He wants to observe them as if they were bacteria under a microscope, and I don't think that's what Steinbeck is doing at all. There's a very clear distinction between Doc Burton's perspective and Steinbeck's related but very different perspective at the same time. And you look at In Dubious Battle, and you really don't have the same depth of characterization that you do in The Grapes of Wrath. You don't really know any of these people. We get limited.
How do you think that would change the novel if we had more characterization? Do you think that would change the kind of thematic content of the novel?
I don't think the themes would land really any differently. I think it might help in readerly engagement to have something to latch onto with these characters. The novel starts with us being associated with Jim, who dies in very anticlimactic fashion in the final chapter. We end up associating a little more with Mac, but again, we meet this fully formed character whose perspective doesn't really change at any point.
Let's do a little background for folks before we dig into some of the kind of more thematic and character-based questions I had. Can you give us, in broad strokes, a picture of what agricultural labor looked like at this point in the 1930s in California? This is in the midst of the Great Depression. There's a lot of challenges. There's industry is developing. Agriculture is business at this point. But give us maybe the labor perspective, what that looked like.
Yeah, it's important to note that agriculture in California in the 1930s is a big business. These are not Jefferson's yeoman farmers or anything a few steps up from that. The Tagus Ranch, where there was one of the strikes that inspired In Dubious Battle, was a sprawling ranch of like 7,000 acres. It produced at that time a significant percentage of the nation's peaches. As in any big business, the owners are trying to maximize profit by whatever means necessary. So this involves paying workers a pittance. And in the Tagus Ranch, they're paid that pittance in cash, or paid that pittance in scrip redeemable at a company store where prices are 25 to 30% higher than they are in town. Have workers often living in camps, either on the ranch property or close to substandard housing. You have problems with sanitation, issues of that nature. And then in California agriculture, you have this large itinerant workforce that moves from crop to crop based on the planting season. You have people with connection to any locale, any community. You have children out in the factory, in the fields. Same difference as the factories.
Yeah, factories in the fields, right?
Exactly. I have Carrie McWilliams' book right over here. Yeah.
Another kind of slice sociologically that Steinbeck portrays is labor organizers. Mm-hmm. And he's coming at it with a particular perspective. Can you contrast for us what we understand about labor organization that was going on during that time, and then what it tells us about Steinbeck's view based on how he portrayed labor organizers in this novel?
Okay. Yeah. So I think one important point to consider is that prior to the strikes depicted or that influenced In Dubious Battle, there had been minimal attempts to organize agricultural workers really since the dissolution of the industrial workers of the world and the Palmer Raids of 1920. But in 1930, the Canarian Agricultural Workers Industrial Union formed, and they were the first organization to really attempt to organize field workers in California. And the period of 1933-1934 was really their high water mark. They had two very successful strikes, the cotton strike in October of 1933 and the Tagus Ranch strike in August of 1933 that preceded that. But the reaction really set in by 1934. The state's criminal syndicalism acts were used to imprison their leadership, including Pat Chambers and Caroline Decker, who were the main organizers in the strikes that Steinbeck drew on for In Dubious Battle. Apparently, according to Jackson Benson, Chambers read In Dubious Battle and was pissed by the portrayal of Mac, who was supposedly loosely based on him. There's this clear sense in the novel that a lot of the criticism has really latched onto, that Mac is manipulating the workers towards some broader, abstract, revolutionary end. I don't know if that's entirely accurate to the characterization of Mac in the novel, but that is the critical consensus, and that's apparently what Chambers thought as well. But most of the organizers for the CAWIU, doesn't really roll off the tongue. I'll see what I can do about that over the course of the rest of the interview here. They were very small teams of organizers. They would often just be a handful of people. And Steinbeck, in his planning for the novel, he met two labor organizers who went by the names of Cecil McKitty and Carl Williams, who had been active in the cotton strike in October of 1933. So he learned the events of these strikes on the inside from those two organizers, and he initially planned to write like a nonfiction account from the point of view of a labor organizer, then realized that he actually had the basis for a novel here, and that was the start of In Dubious Battle. But yeah, and his organizers are quite different from the organizers in the actual strike, who were very much dedicated to the immediate needs of the workers in question, increasing their wages, improving their conditions, giving them more say in the agricultural workplace. Steinbeck, that's in Mac's character by all means, but the more manipulative ends are things that Steinbeck definitely foregrounds.
Let's talk about the title for a second. In Dubious Battle is a reference to Milton's poem, which I made my way through a couple years ago. That's not an easy lift in some respects. Beautiful. Some of the greatest poetry ever written. But what's that famous quote? No one's ever wished it was longer or something like that.
Right.
That I've attributed to. But I'm curious because I did a podcast interview about To a God Unknown, and the metaphysics of there couldn't be more different. It's almost kind of magical realism in that book with elements of people living inside of trees. And then here, it's seemingly grounded in some kind of cosmic metaphysics, but then it's just a realist story. Help us to understand what we should do with this reference in the title. Is that something we should read into the work? Is it something that's metaphorical? Is there some metaphysics here that are just simmering beneath the surface? What do you think's going on?
I'm sure that, definitely all those elements are there. I also, to me, I tend to emphasize more on the realist elements of the work. The fact that Steinbeck used that same title in one of his pieces about the plight of migrant workers in California, Dubious Battle in California, that appeared in The Nation. Now, later in 1936, the same year as the novel's publication. So those elements are definitely there. They speak to Steinbeck's kind of avowed theme of man's eternal bitter warfare with himself. But in my readings, those definitely are elements that I de-emphasize while acknowledging their presence, of course. And I will confess, one of my secret shame as a Steinbeck scholar, I still have not read To a God Unknown. It's on my shelf. I always find an excuse to read something else.
Yeah, it's certainly strange. I enjoyed it. It feels like an outlier to the rest of his work. And it's fascinating. We can go out down that road. But I want to ask now, continuing with kind of a religious theme here, when we look at the kind of character arc of Jim Nolan in this novel, do you view that as kind of a redemptive arc, or is there a different way you'd characterize the kind of journey he goes through or his process and development in the book?
With Jim, I really don't see much of a redemptive arc. He strikes me as more or less a static character, and I think a more problematic one than Mac. From the outset of the novel, his stakes in the strike and the labor movement in general are deeply personal. He's concerned about the strike in a very individualistic sense, much more than Mac. Mac, on the one hand, wants to provide the workers with the broader set of skills, if you will, that would make a revolutionary action possible, but he's also very much immediately aware of the economic aims of the strike. He understands the need to raise wages. Jim's there to lend some sort of purpose and meaning to his life. He speaks about his father's experiences very early in the novel, and then we leave that, and we see Jim, aside from his interactions with Lisa, various points in the novel, is very much disconnected from the other workers. He even has that great dialogue late in the novel about how he's surpassed Mac and the other workers because he doesn't worry about food or money or staying warm or liquor or tobacco or women or anything else. And then we see some step as he becomes like the uber organizer, and then he's dead. So I don't see a real redemptive arc there. And I don't see one for anybody else in the book. Yeah. It's pretty bleak.
When you look at how the book portrays a strike, it seems like there's a tension between the kind of accidental nature of some of these events and then the broad feeling of determinism in the book. How do we square that circle?
In many formulations of naturalist fiction, when we are talking about ideas of determinism and the forces that shape the characters' fates, there is a large element of chance in there as well. It's chance that kind of sets the operation of Hurstwood's deterioration in Sister Carrie in motion. He's going to return the money, but the safe door shut. We see this in McTeague. We see this in The Octopus. I think we see this here. So it's like Heredity plus environment plus chance equals fate. And I see a lot of that here. Just think of like the element that triggered the strike. Dan, the older worker, falls through a ladder into the horrible conditions under which the workers have that were forced to labor at this time. Yeah, chance plays a big role there, and that's an important distinction from the actual strikes that were the result of a good deal of planning. They weren't spontaneous at all, and makes all sorts of changes, as one would expect, from the source material, especially in terms of his portrayal of violence and the work, the violence associated with the strikers, you know, in particular. And one of the key reasons why both the Tagus Ranch and cotton strikes were successful is that the strikers did not respond to the violent vigilante tactics of the growers and their emissaries with violence of their own, because the vigilantes, local law enforcement, they can handle that. It gives them pretext to break the strike, especially in 1930. The sheriff of Fresno County said that very thing.
Yeah. The book has an interesting theory of violence to me. It almost emerges spontaneously without intent. It's almost like the weather or something. It just comes, an afternoon shower comes. And so I'm curious what do you think Steinbeck is doing with violence here? Is he trying to de-individualize it and make it a symptom of a political situation? Do you think that's what he's trying to portray here?
I think that is a key element here. I think that violence is, in the world of Indubious Battle, the logical and inevitable result of the circumstances and conditions with which these characters are faced. In this world, given these circumstances and the lack of any alternatives for these characters whatsoever, it's difficult to imagine violence not being the end result here. And I think that Steinbeck, for the most part, there's a clear chain, you know, of cause and effect throughout the novel and most of the key portrayals of violence. There's that interaction between Mac and Bolter, the chairman of the Growers Association, where he basically says that if you burn Anderson's barn or touch one of his trees, then we'll let loose 1,000 guys into the valley. You've got to have a box of matches, and this whole place is going to burn. And we don't see that actually occur. It's one striker, Sam, on his own, burning one barn. But there is a process of causation like that. Each act of violence on the part of the strikers is in response to a previous act of violence by the growers. And then the growers and the violence of the growers is, you know, an inevitable and the logical result of conditions and their desire to perpetuate those inequitable conditions as well. So here's a threat to their bottom line. How are they going to respond? And in 1933, this is how they're going to respond.
Mm. So the book seems to have an interesting relationship to this kind of concept of ideology, which drives a lot of leftist movements, working class movements, communist movements. How would you explicate Steinbeck's view of ideology and the role it plays?
So in this book, it's so commonly associated with the proletarian fiction of the period. I guess in subject matter and topic, it certainly does in terms of tone and characterization. It has very little to do with it at all. And in so many of these works, you have your revolutionary hero. There's some sort of inciting incident that turns him into the man he's supposed to be as he takes on the villainous capitalists. A favorite example of mine, so this is an earlier one, it's Jack London's The Iron Heel from 1908 with his protagonist Ernest Everhard. There's a lot we can unpack with that one. We'll save that for later. I mean, Steinbeck is certainly not doing that. These are not idealized, heroic organizers, and Steinbeck was not a communist. He was a New Deal, he was a New Deal Democrat. The CAWIU was a Communist Party affiliated union, and Steinbeck had the utmost respect for the communist organizers in the field who were putting their lives and bodies on the line to promote the cause of labor. But the cocktail circuit communists in New York and Los Angeles, he had nothing but contempt for, especially the one Harry Black, who initially rejected In Dubious Battle for publication at Kovicki because he objected to the ideology in the book. The characterization of the communist organizers was unfair, which Steinbeck thought was just absolutely ridiculous. There's many different communist ideologies as there are communists, he wrote in effect to his agent, Elizabeth Otis.
Let me ask you some kind of broad questions now. If Steinbeck was around today, do you think what's transpired with agriculture is a confirmation of his ideas about it from found in these books?
Yeah, I would be inclined to believe that and agree with that. I think a lot of what we're seeing in agriculture, in California state politics, and everything else is an extension of so much of what Steinbeck was dealing with and writing against in the 1930s. And I think that one thing that keeps readers coming back to Steinbeck's fiction all over and over again through generations and decades is the relevance of his subject matter, not just the universal themes and concerns of these works, but some of the basic situations in these, which are things that we have not sadly outgrown as a nation and a people. And these concerns are very much present, and I think especially over the last few years.
You're from California. You're familiar with the locales in these books. I'm curious how, though, doing research as a scholar on these books has changed your understanding of California and California history.
I found when I began studying Steinbeck as a scholar and getting into California history as a scholar, I had a very superficial understanding of and grasp of California history, that my understanding of California really began in about 1930 or so, and there was a lot further back of that I had to go. And just kind of going back to the history of the Gold Rush, the Mexican era, land grants, the role of the Union Pacific and Southern Pacific in California history and politics and everything else, the extent to which they control the state, like the four successive governors and so on and so forth, was eye-opening for me. I'm not at all surprising, but here's more of it I can draw on here. And just delving deeper into California labor history, I was aware of the San Francisco general strike and major events like I'd heard of the cotton strike and a few others. There was a well-known strike in Santa Rosa, my hometown, in 1935 that was part of the Associated Farmers reprisals against the successes of the CAWIU. I got it that time in 1933, and this labor dispute involved, among other things, the organizers being beaten and dragged through town and being forced to kiss the American flag on the courthouse steps, and then they were forced to leave town. Those who didn't were tarred and feathered. That's Santa Rosa in 1935.
Wow. The next work we're going to read in our series is Of Mice and Men. Is there anything that we should take from In Dubious Battle and carry forward with us to our reading of Mice and Men?
Well, we ponder
that. You know, earlier
we talked about
this idea of a labor trilogy, and I think there's arguments for and against that kind of interpretive reading, but I'm just curious if there's a building here in terms of his ideas as they develop over these next two books.
Yeah. Mice and Men is an important kind of transitional work, if we look at this as a trilogy, into The Grapes of Wrath. Here we see a broader sympathy with his working class characters that's there in Dubious Battle, but they're in a much more general sense, but here we really see a broader identification in the marginalized, the dispossessed, those outside the mainstream of American society, the victims of that same society, in a way that really guides us into the grapes of wrath.
We're going to close with my favorite section, which is book recommendations. What are a few books you'd like to recommend to listeners, either about this specific book or Steinbeck or California history?
The book that I would... So my favorite kind of parallel text to A Dubious Battle and The Grapes of Wrath is Carrie McWilliams' Factories in the Field. It came out in 1939, around the same time as the Grapes of Wrath. It was taken by many to be a confirmation of the ideas that Steinbeck was presenting in the book. And McWilliams was an editor for The Nation for 20 years. He also was California Commissioner of Immigration and Housing for years as well. So when I was trying to understand the economic circumstances undergirding In Dubious Battle, this really was the first place that I looked. And again, I've gone through this so many times, it's missing pages in various places as well. If I wanted to read it, I would be forced to buy a new copy.
Maybe make the case for people that maybe think that journalism written in the 1930s is not as relevant. Like, why is Factories in the Field still a relevant book given its age and our ideas have developed about agricultural labor?
I will say just my general practice as a scholar is I always want to see how texts engage with and are informed by their immediate historical context. These are the foundations for these works and are always the foundation for my understanding of these works as well. And the conditions, again, in California in the 1930s, we like to think are quite removed from the circumstances of the present. They're not. They're only slightly removed from the conditions that we have to deal with, and they, again, are the foundation of so many problems that continue to plague us. Not sure that was the best sales pitch, but
I think it's a good one. Close. Dr. Dawson, what are you working on next?
I am in between projects at the moment. I'm trying to work on a new book project, and I'm kind of basically working on two parallel tracks here. I wanted to do a study on London in particular, looking at the influence of his socialist thought on his major fiction, see how these ideas undergird the adventure stories with which he is synonymous, but then later parlay into his more overtly kind of socially conscious works in the period between 1903 through 1909, and then how they manifested his later works like Valley of the Moon and Burning Daylights and things like that. The other idea I'm toying with is another book project that looks at the influence of naturalist fiction on writers that we don't commonly associate with naturalism, like F. Scott Fitzgerald and William Faulkner and Thomas Wolfe and John O'Hara. That, I think, ultimately is a project that I'll be spending more time with going forward. I have a chapter on Faulkner in a fairly advanced state. Needs a ton of work, but at least there's something to work with.
Yeah. Hopefully this conversation has piqued people's interest in picking up In Dubious Battle. I'd encourage them to do that. And Dr. Dawson, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.